This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Jim Matheson, CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Bayer. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers agreed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NRECA's Jim Matheson next. Trial lawyers are using a discredited report from a World Health Organization sub-agency to attack a safe, American-made weed-fighting tool. This tool helps keep your food costs down, and without it, food inflation could double. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. 90 years ago, the major utility companies weren't interested in bringing electricity to rural America, so the rural citizens banded together and did it themselves. It was the Rural Electrification Act that established what is now the Rural Utility Service, a critical source of funding for rural co-ops. NRECA CEO Jim Matheson said rural communities would never have grown without resources from the federal government.
Well, you know, 90 years ago, rural America, most everyone did not have electricity. And this was during the Roosevelt administration. During the Depression, he recognized the need to bring electricity to rural America because you can't have economic opportunity without it. So they passed this bill, the Rural Electrification Act, where the Department of Agriculture would offer low-cost loans to help build out infrastructure to bring electricity to rural America. And what's really interesting is they first offered it to for-profit utilities, and they said, we're not going to do it anyway. Even with these low-cost loans from the government, it's not in our interest to do it. So people in rural America, they each put in $5, which back then was a lot of money, to form their own cooperative owned by the members that all put the money in. And they formed their own cooperatives, and they went to the federal government and said, we want to build it out ourselves. And the Roosevelt administration said, okay, we're going to do this. And they've been providing loans to electric cooperatives to build out infrastructure, starting then to electrify rural America. It's one of the great successes, in my opinion, in the history of the federal government in terms of investing in rural America. And by the way, we don't default on our loans. So over this 90-year history, it's made money for the federal government. You know, in an era where everyone talks about deficits, electric co-ops pay their bills. And so even today, 90 years later, it's such a critical source of low-cost capital to make investments in rural America. And it's just as important today as it was then. So I find that a remarkable history, that something's been around for 90 years and it's still as important as it's ever been, because we got a lot of important investments to make in rural America, and the Department of Agriculture has been a great partner in that effort. Another chapter of that has to do with broadband now for rural America, and the Rural Utility Service helps fund electric co-ops deploying broadband as well. It's like, you know, history repeats itself. Here we are where the for-profit companies aren't interested in providing broadband to these low population or sparsely populated areas. And the electric co-op says, we'll do it because there are members, there are owners, we're going to do this for them. And so it's interesting how this model of the rural electric cooperative owned by the communities it serves makes decisions on behalf of its members. And broadband, of course, in this day and age, in this economy, how do you survive without it? It's actually, in my opinion, an existential threat to any rural community that doesn't have broadband. I don't know how you survive in today's economies.
How has demand for electricity grown, and what pressure is that putting on co-ops to meet that demand?
It's a really interesting question because, you know, for a long time, equipment was getting more efficient, and we were using less electricity for the same things we tried to do. So even though there was some economic growth, for a long time in the 2000s and 2010s, electricity demand as a country stayed kind of flat. It wasn't growing much. But starting around 2020, man, demand started to boom for a lot of reasons. We're using a lot more electricity in our economy, whether it's heat pumps or switching from diesel to electric irrigation pumps, or whether it's electric vehicles, or whether it's onshoring of manufacturing that's coming back here. And now, of course, data centers and artificial intelligence have also created another element of new demand. So suddenly demand started to grow. And in the electric sector, you don't create new infrastructure overnight. You know, building a power plant or building a big transmission line, that's a multi-year effort. And we need long-term planning to make that happen. And it's been difficult to move forward as an industry to meet this demand. At the same time, at the federal level, we've had policies that have encouraged the shutting down of existing power plants with useful life left. That doesn't make sense. We're digging deeper by shutting down power plants that still have useful life. So we've been, as electric cooperatives and as the head of the National Association, we've been a voice at the federal level saying the federal government, you got a problem. Our role is to keep the lights on, and you are pursuing policies that make that more difficult for us to do. So number one, stop shutting down existing power plants before they can be reasonably replaced at a minimum. And number two, let's see if we can clean up some of these federal rules and regulations that make it so difficult to build some in this country these days, because we need to get going. We need to build new infrastructure. We're prepared to invest in our rural communities, and we need to have a reasonable, predictable process to do that. We're doing everything we can do on that regard. But I can tell you that the permitting process at the federal level and the different rules and regulations could be made better. And that's a big agenda that we're pursuing in Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C., there's been the war on coal. And not only did that impact the plants, but it impacted the communities where coal is rich and mining jobs were important to communities. And how has this environmental concern, has it tipped too far where it is impeding your ability to provide and opportunities to meet the demand that's coming?
Well, I'm not an engineer, so this is about as technical as I get, but I like to say there's two types of power generation. There's the kind that's always available, like, a coal plant or a nuclear plant or a natural gas plant. And then there's the other kind of power generation that's intermittent. It's not always available 24/7. That would be wind or solar. And you need that always available generation to be reliable. Now, that doesn't mean you can't supplement it with some of that intermittent stuff. That's fine as part of a bigger portfolio. But when you start undercutting the overall electric supply portfolio, where you're taking out these always available types of generation, and coal plants are clearly in that category, that's where you start to draw real concern about, how do we reliably keep the lights on? It's something that everyone takes for granted. You know, we all do. You go into the room, you flip a switch and the light goes on. You don't really give it any second thought. But I'll tell you what, when it doesn't go on, it sure gets your attention. And we've got to be thoughtful about keeping these reliable, always available generating sources as a significant part of the electric supply portfolio. So look, for electric co-op, we don't say we favor one technology over another, but we certainly say you need enough of this always available generation to make sure we can keep the lights on 24/7.
So of these data centers and of the growth in cities and towns and urban areas and communities alike, how is base load demand continuing to grow? And what are the biggest areas that are putting a strain on that baseload demand?
Well, there's no question these data centers, particularly when the ones that supply artificial intelligence, they run 24/7. That's baseload. And we're talking about significant consumers of power. We're talking about some of these, you know, data centers have been around for a long time for storing data, where when you always hear about the cloud, those are smaller data centers, but now they're building really big data centers in terms of power demand. Yeah, they need power 24/7. And by the way, oftentimes there's a lot of power available in those off-peak hours where utilities aren't selling any electrons. So at one level, the utilities say, hey, if someone wants to take my power when I'm not selling it otherwise, that's good news. The problem is, what do you do during the on-peak times when everyone wants their electricity as well, including the data center? So this is a lot of pressure on the electric system. How do we handle this? And by the way, data centers don't just create pressure on the electric system. There's a lot of local siting issues that matter too. They consume a lot of water. They take up a lot of land. And so what we've approached as the National Association of Electric Co-ops is, we want every co-op to be able to make their own decision about what makes sense for them. In some locations, there may be a place where it does make sense to do a data center. In other locations, it may make sense to not do a data center. And we don't want federal policies or even state policies to create a one-size-fits-all, this is the way it should be. We want each co-op to be able to make the right decision for their local community. Because again, they're owned by those communities. They should be making the decisions about what they want and don't want. And these data centers create a lot of complicated issues that people need to work through. But that's really a big driver of demand. And so you're asking the right question.
Are there areas where the base just on a normal day is facing a capacity load?
It turns out there's this organization that I like to call the electric grid watchdog for the country. They're called the North American Reliability Corporation. And that's what they do. They analyze the status of the electric grid, and they look at different regions, and they look at projected demand and projected supply, and they put out these 10-year forecasts saying here's what we see to the future. And they print a map, and they'll show you where it's red, yellow, or green. You know, red's the danger zone where we're really at risk. Yellow's where it could be a risk. Green says we're still okay. And more and more of the country's turning red on that map, which is not good news. We are not building new power generation at the rate we need to. Demand is growing. And as I said earlier, we're shutting down some plants at the same time. We're going the wrong direction. There's a peak in the summer, but there's also a peak in the winter. And in some ways, historically, summer was where everyone talked about big electric use, but the reason winter peak is so important is because during those cold snaps, that's when a lot of people are also using natural gas to keep warm in their house, right? They're running their furnace. And we have shifted as a country where we use a lot more natural gas in terms of how we generate electricity as well. So the natural gas system gets stressed during those cold snaps. And so winter peak and summer peak both matter. A lot of regions of the country are at risk under peak conditions. Under normal situations, I don't think much of the country's at risk today, but under peak situations, summer, winter, that's where we're squeezing the margins real thin. And by the way, we've had a couple of situations in the last couple of years where it's happened. We had 9 states in the mid-Atlantic area, North Carolina, Virginia, where on Christmas Eve, it got real cold and there wasn't enough gas in the pipelines to both serve all the heating of the homes and also the power plants. We had rolling blackouts in 9 states on Christmas Eve in 2023. So it can happen. This isn't theoretical. And as we keep growing electric demand, the threat of that happening only grows as well.
So nearly 100 years ago, when folks put their money together and formed their co-ops, they were looking to take care of themselves and perhaps their farms, their businesses. They're still supplying that today through the co-op. But now you have data centers, you have other areas that are coming in that are consuming tremendous amounts of electricity, and everybody's rates are going up. Some might say it's not fair to have new business come in and push my rates higher. How do you address that?
Well, I think this is a topic that's gotten a lot of conversation, and a lot of people are saying that there's a way to structure this in the terms of the business relationships with data centers, where data centers pay their fair share. That's certainly the position of us representing all of the country's co-ops. The Trump administration has said the same thing. Data centers ought to pay their fair share. And by the way, these large hyperscalers that are building these massive data centers, we're talking about massively valuable tech companies that have got tons of resources, they should pay their fair share. And so if we can structure it the right way, and again, that's an if, and it's a really complicated set of negotiations, there are ways to make this work where it could be a win-win, but you got to be careful, because if you don't do it the right way, existing consumers really could get hurt by this. But as I said a couple of minutes ago, data centers use power 24/7, and a lot of times the electric grid, you know, you build for your peak. So you got all this capacity that's not being used for many, many hours of the year. If data centers are creating a revenue stream for all those hours, that's a value to the utility. So there's some trade-offs here that we can look at. But again, local decision matters, because as I said, water use, land use, these are all local decisions where the local community ought to make the right decision. And they better be real smart when they sit down at the table and negotiate a deal, because if they negotiate the right way, they can make it work. But this is a brave new world we're in. I'll tell you, a lot of new data centers coming in, and everybody's got to be really careful about making decisions.
Jim, is there electric storage technology that would help to guard us from the highs, the lows, and take advantage of those times when the load is not as strong?
In a limited way, yes. Their battery storage technology generally gives you about a 4 hours of storage. So battery storage can be really good for kind of shifting load and managing your peak a little bit. So it's a tool in the toolbox, but quite candidly, when you have these cold snaps and you got massive demand in the peak winter that goes for, you know, 4 or 5 days, that 4 hours doesn't help you. And so the hope, of course, is that technology evolves where we can have battery storage that is a much longer duration than 4 hours. But there is some value, and a lot of utility systems are incorporating batteries to help manage their loads on a day-to-day basis. And so that's where battery storage is today. But quite candidly, if you could get long duration storage in the future, that would be a game changer for the electric system. But the technology's just not evolved today.
How much do we need to increase our electric generation to meet demand? And is the transmission system adequate to provide that?
Oh man, those are two great questions, actually. The first is, you'll see all kinds of projections for how much we're going to need more electricity in the next 5 or 10 years. But even so, there's all these different projections. In all cases, we need a lot more. There's some that say we need, and I'm just going to use a term and I'll explain what it is, at least 100 gigawatts of new generation over the next 10 years. What's a gigawatt? That's a nuclear power plant. It's 1 gigawatt. So we need 100 new nuclear power plants in the next 10 years. That gives you some quantification for how much more electricity we may very well need in this country over the next 10 years. And then as you got it, just because you build a power plant doesn't mean you can automatically deliver electricity to where it needs to go. You got to invest in transmission, which are the high voltage lines that, by the way, cost a lot of money and it's hard to get them sited. But if you have more of a robust transmission system, it allows you to move electricity around regionally, and it helps manage those peaks. Because, you know, we mentioned that issue with winter and cold snaps, and sometimes those are isolated to certain regions of the country. And if you can deliver more power from elsewhere, that's one other way to help manage the peak, as opposed to just saying we just got to build all new generation to manage the peak. So you've identified the two variables that have to be addressed as a country if we're going to meet this demand: is new generation and new transmission. And in both cases, we need a federal system that allows us to build things in a thoughtful, timely way and not be dragging through permitting processes that take years and years and years to get resolved.
So how about Mom Nature or climate change? We could put both of those at the top of the page here. How is the shifting of climate and the extremes that we have seen from weather events and others, how has this been a wreck in the system?
Well, it's clearly created these more extended peaks, hotter summers, colder winters. You know, you've seen it happen. And that stresses the electric system as well. So, these extreme weather events really create the peak moments. You know, it's funny. A lot of people say, you know, for 340, 350 days in the year, we don't have a problem. But it's those 20 to 25 days a year in the summer and winter where we do have a problem in terms of electric demand. And these extreme weather events really accentuate those circumstances during those peak days.
Have you recovered from hurricanes and from wildfires and other extreme events that have obviously impacted infrastructure?
Well, those are happening more and more frequently. And one of the big efforts going on with electric co-ops is, number one, seeing if they're looking for various ways we can make investments to harden our systems. Again, I'm not an engineer, so I can't get too technical, but whether there are areas where you should bury lines underground so during hurricanes they're not subject to having the poles get knocked over in high winds, whether we can protect assets from wildfire risk, and then also whether we can go out and clear out rights of way and clear away vegetation so trees aren't falling on lines to cause fires as well. Those are all issues that are much more in play now than they were 20 years ago. And electric co-ops are making significant investments to try to prevent the risk at the front end and to harden their systems so that they can keep the lights on even when these events happen. But it's a growing concern. And by the way, it's not limited to electric co-ops. The whole electric system in this country, the other types of utilities as well, face these risks. But in the case of electric co-ops, we cover 56% of all the land in the United States. So we cover a lot of areas. So when it comes to wildfires or hurricanes or ice storms or derechos or whatever it, flooding, whatever it is, it really impacts our members more because we cover so much of the land in this country.
Jim, is Washington listening? Because clearly if we don't meet the needs of the co-op as it attempts to satisfy the need of the nation, then down the line, we're vulnerable for a break.
Look, it's a great question. And I think, you know, we all know that politics is pretty complicated these days. But to me, there are some glimmers of hope. And one is this. Traditionally, when it came to reforming our overall regulatory and permitting process to make it more streamlined, that used to be an argument of business on one side and environmental concerns on the others. That has softened. It's not such a binary choice because the environmentalists have figured out it's hard to build a new solar plant, too, because of permitting, it turns out. So there is a growing consensus in a more bipartisan way in Washington that permitting reform really does have to happen, that it's just gotten too darn hard to build some in this country, and there ought to be a more reasonable way to go about doing it. Now, just because that consensus is building, don't let me oversell you on this. It doesn't mean they're going to create a whole new set of permitting laws tomorrow and it's all going to be fixed. But I do see a greater awareness, and I do see a lot more conversation on Capitol Hill in a bipartisan way in both the House and the Senate. So that's the good news there. When it comes to shortages of supply chain issues, I can tell you the Trump administration has been very good at listening to us about when we raise these concerns and describe where supply chain shortages are happening to make it difficult to move ahead on investments in electric systems. And they're looking at what they can do. It's not like they can just wave a magic wand and fix it, but we're looking where the federal government has capacity to help ease some of these restrictions. So I can tell you there is at least a good understanding and dialogue on this issue, but we got a long way to go to get it fixed.
I find it interesting from the environmental aspect. Obviously, if you can build a solar field or you can add wind farms and you can provide electricity from natural resources without digging it, it makes sense. But at the point that you're taking up quality farmland, is your return on investment, and I mean from the environmental aspect and from the soil, is it better to have a plant that can generate on a small amount of acres compared to the acres and acres that are being consumed with solar fields and wind turbines?
Yeah, it's again, you've done your homework because you're asking another really good question. And that's why we think that, again, and it's our model, because I talk about it all the time with electric co-ops, we don't think there should be a one-size-fits-all from the federal government. We want our local cooperatives who are owned by the communities they serve to make those decisions. And they know the land, and they know the value of it, and there are places where maybe it makes sense to do these things, and there are places where it doesn't. And it's important for local communities to have the authority and the control to make those decisions.
Well, Jim, natural disasters are real, and we have seen much more of those than we have in times past. Is there help from the government that really allows you to restore the system to where it needs to be?
Yeah, when it comes to electric cooperatives, because we're nonprofit and we return all excess revenues to our consumers, a decision was made decades ago that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, helps compensate electric cooperatives for repairs based on storm damage. And it's been a partnership that's meant a lot to electric cooperatives in rural communities because, quite frankly, otherwise all those costs would get passed on to the consumers in those towns where these things have happened. And these are these natural disasters happen everywhere. We did an analysis for the last 15 years. You've had a FEMA disaster event in 433 of the 435 congressional districts in America. So while the hurricanes are the big ones that cover wide areas, between ice storms and wind storms and wildfires and flooding, it happens everywhere. And this relationship that electric co-ops have with FEMA is an important one in terms of maintaining and rebuilding systems after disasters. However, the relationship could be better. And we've talked for a long time about reforming FEMA to make it more accountable, more timely, and more responsive. And the exciting news is we've got legislation in Congress that was introduced in a bipartisan way. And there's not a lot going on bipartisan in D.C. these days, but this one really happened. Sam Graves, congressman from Missouri, head of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee in the House, a Republican, and the lead Democrat on that committee is Rick Larson from Washington State, and they've introduced FEMA reform legislation that really would make it even better agency in terms of assisting rural co-ops in terms of rebuilding systems. We're excited about the bill. It passed through their committee on a vote of 57-3, and when does that happen in Washington these days? We're in a bipartisan vote. There's big consensus, but there is on this bill. It's a crowded calendar. We're trying to get the full House to vote on it now, but this is a big issue for us. The relationship with FEMA is a critical partnership for electric co-ops, And we're going to do everything we can do to keep making that relationship better if we can get this legislation passed.
So there are those who suggest that you should thank a farmer every time you sit down at the table at least three times a day. Jim, I think about the rural electric co-op every time I push a switch and make the lights come on, or I fire up my computer or watch something on television. You clearly have a huge role in the success of the nation of continuing to provide electrical service to our businesses, to our farms, and to support our way of life. Jim, thanks for being with us on this edition of Open Mic. And it is Open Mic. You're our guest, and today you have the last word.
Well, I just first of all want to thank you for the opportunity and for all the nice things you said about how important reliable, affordable power is for communities. I like to add one more component to that, and that is electric cooperatives. Their first mission is about providing reliable and affordable power, but they're also focused on making the community a better place. They're owned by the communities they serve. The communities elect the board that governs electric co-ops. And so anyone listening, if you have a co-op in your area, you know this. The co-op is so invested in making sure the community is thriving. They invest in the community to make it a better place to live. It's a really special relationship. And every day when I go to work, I know I'm supporting all these co-ops that have that mission to do the right thing for the people they serve. So I enjoy it, and I hope everyone recognizes that's another value the cooperatives bring.
Our thanks to this week's guest, Jim Matheson, CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Bayer. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Dowling.